the week of November 1st, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 27, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And high above Manhattan, waiting for Game 6 of the World Series, I'm Michael Giltz.
That's right. You have season tickets to the Yankees, and the Phillies won yesterday, Game 5, so I guess Game 6 is tomorrow, Wednesday. We're recording on a Tuesday because of travel plans and travel schedules. It was just easier to record on a Tuesday.
And I got a phone call from someone wondering where the podcast was.
Are you serious?
Wait, yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to seem surprised at that. We have many listeners all over the world that wait eagerly each week for our podcast. This episode, of course, might be called the Crow Pie episode, thanks to this week's box office returns.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh!
Well, normally I was going to say we should switch it up and start at number 10 and work our way up to number 1. But given that, Michael, many episodes ago you predicted that Sony would lose their shirt and their studio and their socks and everything else they owned on the Michael Jackson rehearsal footage movie, This Is It. I think, you might want to let people know what happened.
Well, let's start off with the box office there. Michael Jackson's This Is It debuted at number 1 with $23.2 million over the Halloween weekend, which is about a third of what people were wildly predicting in the last 2 weeks, but still makes it instantly the second most successful concert film of all time, if you call it a concert film, or one of the 10 best documentary films in the U.S. of all time, if you consider it a documentary film. Running through the other top 10, because This Is It is the only one there's really anything to talk about. Paranormal Activity made another $16.3 million. It's up to $84 million. It's going to hit $100 million next week. Law Abiding Citizen, the Nothing movie with Jamie Foxx and Gerard Butler, made $7.4 million. That's at $51 million. Couples Retreat is fading out. It's got a total of $87 million. Where the Wild Things Are is dropping a little fast, I'm sorry to say, but it's at $62 million.
I know it dropped 60%. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Saw 6 is made $5.2 million, definitely underperforming for the Saw series, but there will be a Saw 7. That's at $22 million total. Astro Boy is coming and going quickly. That's at a total of $11 million. The Stepfather is at $24 million total. Cirque du Freak is disappearing quickly at $10 million. And Amelia, which was touted as an Oscar hopeful, did not get good reviews or do well at the box office. It expanded further. It made $3 million this week, and that's a total of $8 million.
Yeah, I was surprised. Amelia last week came in 11th, and this week it came in 10th, and it only dropped 22%. But of course, it added 250 screens in North America.
Yeah, there's no way to paint it as anything other than a disappointment. Clearly, they thought they would have a movie that would get good reviews and draw in the older audiences, but it's opened way too low to ever amount to much of anything. Have you seen it yet, Karen?
I'm not going to see Amelia, not after what I've heard about it. But you know what I did see last night was This Is It.
Oh, well, let's talk about it as a movie first. What did you think?
As a movie? As opposed to what?
As opposed to how it performed at the box office.
Oh, yeah, I was actually sort of surprised by how not very well it didn't do at the box office.
Well, that's because expectations were set at the $65 million mark, which I think was a little unrealistic for a film like this.
Yeah, but given the fact that you and I, Sperling, have been saying, you know, this is Michael Jackson, I mean, he's like people's god, I thought it would do better. But what did I think of it? I was embarrassingly entertained, really. I didn't think I was going to like it. I was a little concerned I was going to be bored. But what this movie makes you realize is just how incredibly talented he was, because you can't take your eyes off him. He's so talented in himself. He's so good at picking really talented people. I mean, those dancers were incredible. And Orianthe, Sperling, you and I have talked about her before. She's the blonde guitarist. I mean, what a star in the making. I was so entertained.
Well, she performed at the Grammys. And I think I was on Twitter at the time. And the number of people that were
wanted
talking
to know who she was.
Yeah, everybody wanted to know who she was. And it took me a while. It took me like five or six minutes, but I found out who she was. And then the next thing, you know, she's in this.
Yeah, she's a guitarist in the film who has the big Beat It solo.
Yeah. They were starting. He had died shortly about that same time, I think, and they were showing clips of it. But I was just so thoroughly entertained. And, you know, when they played, you know, anything from Thriller to, you know, Beat It to even Smooth Criminal, I was so into it. I was I was shocked and a little embarrassed.
Well, I don't think you have anything to be embarrassed about. I mean, let's face it. The reason a movie like this works and the reason Michael Jackson still had a career is because there is some kind of 80s, early 90s nostalgia factor to him and to his music. And so we grew up during that time period. Therefore, there's no reason to be embarrassed.
Well, I disagree on every level with everything you guys said.
Oh, what a surprise.
Well, first, I don't think it's 80s nostalgia. It's the best-selling original album of all time. It didn't matter whether it came out in the 60s or the 90s. It's a great, great album. So it's got nothing to do with nostalgia. It's great music. It's timeless. But it's not like, oh, we're having an 80s revival. It's Thriller, the best-selling album of all time. So I think that music endures. But I'm surprised to hear how entertained you said you were. I found it interesting to watch once, but the crowd I saw, and I saw it with a black and Latino audience on a Friday night, they were thoroughly nonplussed and bored. I thought it would have made a very interesting DVD extra, but I thought as a film it was, you know, I found it interesting to watch him work through songs. He's sort of mumbling his way through a lot of songs. The only times you really hear like full-blown versions are when they play the old track over the footage that they're showing, which is what they did on Thriller and one or two other songs. But most of the time he's going, la da 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 da, the high heels on, la da da da.
But he's conserving his voice. Don't make him use his voice. Don't make him use it.
Oh, I understand, but we're watching him mumble his way and practice his dance moves. And I found it interesting how they put together that show and the focus on it and how they all sort of cater to him, as you would. But it's like he keeps saying things like, oh, could you turn that mic up a little bit? I say that with love, L-O-V-E, love.
Yeah, that was hysterical. Or with like the earbud things in his ears, you know, yeah, what they listen to.
Someone is fisting
it's
me.
Pushing, it's fisting. Pushing, it's pushing, it's pushing. And Kenny Ortega, the director, is so good with him because he would be like, Michael, what do you need? Turn it down a little bit. All right, can we turn that down? I mean, but that to me was what the movie was about. To me, this wasn't a concert movie. This was almost like Madonna's Truth or Dare. It was a story of how you deal with a megastar, how you put together, you know, a concert of that magnitude. And that, to me, I would have been more interested to have seen the auditions. And, I mean, I wish that they had more footage of that.
Well, they don't want to see the dancers. You know, people want to see Michael. But, I mean, it is interesting to watch. But let's face it, it's not Truth or Dare. We're basically across the arena from him. We're almost never up close to Michael Jackson. He's 20, 30 feet away, and we're watching him rehearse. And it's really fun. I'd love to have sat in the arena and done it. And it was fun to see once, but we're not up close and personal. We don't get to know him. We're always at arm's distance.
I had no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I worked on Truth or Dare, and I can tell you.
What did you do on Truth or Dare?
Yeah.
I was a production assistant, production coordinator on the East Coast.
Very cool.
And yeah, I mean, there were certainly a lot of interesting moments that were filmed. I mean, when you point a camera at Madonna for 24 hours a day, you're going to get something interesting. Now, what I think is interesting about this particular production of Michael Jackson's This Is It, and Ben Fritz really captured it in his article titled This Is It as His Personal Thriller, and he interviews Tim Patterson, a commercial director, who was one of two people who were hired to film these rehearsals, and he only had two $6,000 Sony cameras during the entire production. And if he had known what was going to happen, he would have used 12 cameras, and he would have kept the body mics on instead of using the camera mics during most of the filming. That's why they put those
have subtitling on Michael. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because they didn't put a body mic on him thinking, well, this will just be used for some quick little cuts. Of course, in the end, he wound up spending 6 months on this project not directing, but editing all of this footage, 140 hours of the footage together for Sony. It's a fascinating article. You should really read it. We'll place a link to it in the show notes. Well, certainly, Michael, it made $23 million. Everybody was predicting 65 going into it. When I was at Show East last week, a lot of the exhibitors went out on Wednesday night or whenever it was first released into theaters. They went out to see the midnight show and were really impressed. And these are, I would say mostly I was speaking to women, and Sony's exit polling for This Is It showed that 51% of the audience was female and 62% were over 25. And
well, that's his audience.
Well, right. And it may have only made, if you can say that, only made $23 million on 3,400 screens here in the United States and Canada, but it cleaned up overseas. It made $34.4 million in North America over the five and a half days that it was in theaters. And in foreign grosses, it's made $69.5 million in 98 different countries for a five-day worldwide total of $103.9 million, which it definitely exceeds the lifetime total of Hannah Montana.
Right. If I failed anywhere, it was not in recognizing how much more it would do overseas, where the scandals and stuff didn't hurt Michael Jackson as much. However, the movie is going to drop like a rock next week. It made far less than everybody was wildly predicting. It's going to be lucky to make $200 million worldwide, and that is its break-even point. They still overpaid for the film. It cost them $60 million. How much would it cost to open a film on 18,000 screens instantaneously worldwide, Sperling? That's a huge amount of money, and they marketed it.
You know, it depends on each territory. There's no way to answer that question, but certainly they spent a lot of money on it. Right now it's tracking to do about $200 million, so they'll make their money back. And then, of course, they have the DVD, which will not be coming out before the holidays, as everyone predicted, but will be coming out in either January or February.
But again, Michael Jackson has not, you know, his new stuff has not sold in like a decade. You know, his albums have barely gone platinum or even barely even double platinum even 8-10 years ago. So he's not been a force. And if you're going to buy something on DVD, you're going to buy the videos. I'm sorry, people are not going to be running out to buy 5 million copies of This Is It. They're barely breaking even with the amount of they overspent. It still was a bad bet. It had to double the top grossing concert film of all time just to break even. And it's going to do that so that they made their money back. But that's still not a great bet. You know, getting your money back is not exactly, you know, I'd much rather have Paranormal Activity.
I think that there will be people who will want this on DVD because it shows, you know, Michael Jackson the way Michael Jackson really is. And that you can get on like Billie Jean and Thriller. I mean, you can see his talent. You can see the classic, you know, MJ. But I think the people who really, really love him want to see him as just being himself.
Do you think the movie will drop next week?
I think it will drop next week.
Yeah, no, I think it will. I think this will do much better on DVD.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think Avatar is going to do? This is another highly anticipated film.
Segway
alert.
Segway!
This is James Cameron's first fiction film since Titanic, I believe. And it's being dubbed Son of Titanic. The second trailer for the film, the first trailer bombed. Everybody hated it.
My God, I hated it.
The second trailer, I saw it at Show East. They showed it at the final night gala dinner. And then everybody ate dinner. Then the executive from Fox came back up on stage after dinner. And he said, look, everybody's been talking about this trailer. Does anybody want to see it again? And everybody applauded and was, you know, going nuts. So I think that, and they showed it again. I think that second trailer is a much better trailer.
Well, I finally understand what the movie is about, and I get a clear sense of who's in it and what their roles are. And I mean, I saw the first trailer and I was like, I'm not going to see that movie. I saw the second trailer and I'm like, I am going to see this.
Yeah, I still feel like it does take 3 minutes just to explain what the heck is going on. It's a guy and he's a soldier. I think maybe he's paralyzed. I'm not sure. And
he's
going to get put in the body of a thing they grow for him. And that's going to be on another planet. And it's a very complicated explanation.
But we saw it last night before This Is It. And the girl who I saw it with, a friend of mine, she turned to me after seeing this and she was like, not bad for an old man director.
James Cameron, an old man director.
But you know what? He is. He's an old man director now.
I wonder if the first trailer wasn't up to snuff or up to what everybody's expectations were because certain elements of the film weren't ready yet, so they couldn't use all of the footage they wanted. Certainly, this second trailer is much better. Another movie that everybody is expecting opens this week, I believe. It was called Push at Sundance. It's called Precious Now. Michael, we saw it in Cannes. I saw it in Sundance and Cannes. It's been at every single film festival known to man this year. Toronto, I think it won. It's at the AFI. It screened at the AFI Festival, which is going on right now. And then Lynn Hirschberg of the New York Times wrote a 5,600-word profile of the movie for the New York Times Magazine. this story just kept going and going and going. I mean, I'm not complaining. I just thought it was really excessive for a movie.
You know, it's gotten really good reviews. I think it's going to be one of those movies that really, like, for me, just kind of like just pulls my heartstrings because I'm like that. But and I thought the one sheet's really good, incidentally. I don't know if I'll pay. I don't know if I'll pay to see it, but it's definitely something that I will Netflix. What do you think,
Sperling? What are your expectations, Sperling?
I think that because of Oprah, this film is going to do quite well. Of course, at Sundance, Oprah had nothing to do with it. She came on after the film won Sundance. Tyler Perry also came on after the film won Sundance. It is a very difficult film. It is not an upbeat movie. I don't necessarily know that people are going to be running out saying, oh my goodness, this is the feel-good movie of the year. But it is a very strong movie and a very well-directed, very well-acted. And I know that there are people who feel it's not well-directed and not well-written and that it's somewhat trite and trivial, but it's...
That would be me.
I mean, you didn't think it was a solid movie?
No, not at all.
Okay, well...
Really?
No, I was very disappointed. You know, I don't wish it ill. I think the lead girl is fine. I think Monique has a very good role. She's the abusive mother of Precious. And I think I agree with Sperling that if anyone's going to get an Oscar nomination, it's Monique. Mariah Carey has a very tiny role. She's fine in it. And Lenny Kravitz has a blink and you miss it role. And, he's fine. But I didn't think it was particularly well directed or good looking. There are fantasy sequences and flashbacks, and it just felt played like a TV movie for me. I don't know how else to describe it. You know, you've got Oprah and Tyler Perry pushing. It's clearly, I guess it's going to open, but it's a tough movie, and I don't, it's not like Slumdog Millionaires where there's a sense of fairy tale about it, and you can see why it would play to a big audience. I still don't quite imagine it playing to a big audience, but you know what? This is a tiny film, and if it makes $30, $40 million, and it almost certainly will with those names pushing it eventually at the very least. Is this movie going to make $100 million like Slumdog and be the Oscar winner? I can't imagine it. Really can't. But, you know, with those names behind it and it's getting consistently good reviews, I'm definitely in the minority. I'm sure it will expand pretty well.
Well, somebody who is pushing fairy tales is Jeffrey Katzenberg, and Maria Bartiromo sat down with him.
Segway!
Yes, I'm the king of segways today.
You really are.
Yes, Maria Bartiromo sat down with Jeffrey Katzenberg for what was, I mean, I don't know if this interview really said anything new other than the fact that DreamWorks Animation is not squelching.
Dead.
No. He said that he in no way, or DreamWorks Animation in no way, is telling their actors that they can't be on Twitter. He said that was just something that somebody Twittered that out and it caught on. He really is a guy, Jeffrey Katzenberg, an executive and producer that stays on message. I've seen this guy talk countless times. I mean, probably dozens of times. And he always sounds exactly the same. He says his quotes exactly the same way, no matter the audience. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. He really knows to stay on how to stay on message. He should be a politician. One of his quotes...
Well, you have to be, I guess, if you're running a big business.
But like a politician... Sometimes you wonder whether you should believe him. And one of his quotes, he says, every time a new platform has come along, the motion picture industry as a whole has usually done a fantastic job of transitioning to it and ultimately gaining revenue. Yeah, if ultimately is like 15 years, sure.
And,
he says,
and transitioning, if you mean fighting it tooth and nail and screaming it will destroy their industry and doing everything they can to block it.
Right. And we're actually going to be talking a little bit about that a little later on when we talk about digital video recorders. But he goes on to say many different platforms have come along, whether it was free TV or pay TV or VHS or DVDs. Clearly, the next major transformation is going to be from hard goods to digital. He also was asked about whether the DVD market was soft, and he agreed that it was soft and has been pretty challenging over the past 12 months. He said people are moving from purchase to rental. And there's been a tremendous spurt in the growth of both Netflix and Redbox, but our CG animated movies are really different from the rest. We are primarily a mom purchase, more analogous to a toy than to a movie. I guess he's discounting all the fathers, thank you very much, but I would agree with him. I would have to say that all of those movies that come out, I go out and buy them.
But of course, it's ridiculous to say that the DVD market is soft. It's just not a new industry anymore. It's going to gross $10 billion this year. They're acting like that's the end of the world. That's what you should expect at this stage of the format. To expect $16, $18, $20 billion is idiotic.
Well, what should he have expected from his Shrek the Musical Broadway extravaganza? Because apparently it closed last week after a disappointing run. And yeah. He's not considering it a failure because they did shoot it and they're going to release it on DVD at some point. And they have a touring company that's going to go around. But it certainly was no Lion King.
No, that was definitely a disappointment. You know, they invest a lot of money in these shows. People were talking about them keeping it on Broadway until the animated Shrek 4 opens up. It's Shrek 4, right? Next summer. But now it looks like they're going to have it in other cities. It's a brand name, and they might be able to work it. You know, it wasn't a flop. It wasn't a disaster. And they kept tweaking it even as it was on the show. So it's even as it was on the board. So it's been improving a little bit. So there's no way to cut it other than a serious disappointment. But they may be able to eke out some more money from it by touring with it.
Well, I'm going to predict now that Shrek 4 appears in next year's Cannes Film Festival lineup because it opens right around that time. But sticking with theater for a moment, I saw that you had highlighted an article from the New York Times about the Finian's Rainbow revival.
That's right. I saw Finian's Rainbow. It's just sort of that phenomenon that happens every once in a while. I saw the show, was very, very disappointed. It found it very thin, and then woke up the next day to find that everybody liked it. Every critic.
Don't you hate when that happens?
I know. You see a movie or you read it, and somebody's like, it's great. And you're like, really? What show did you see? But it's a funny little thing how that happens.
What didn't you like about it?
Oh, it's just not a good show. It's very, very thin. It hasn't been reviewed since 1947. And people argued it was because of the racial subplot. But in fact, it's just a very thin show. It has two songs, That Old Devil Moon and How Are Things in Glockamora. And you're sure to hear them three or four times during the show because it's all they have, so they keep reprising them.
Well, we were just talking about DVDs, and we were talking about Jeffrey Katzenberg, who for years ran Disney, or at least was a large part of running the studios and film side of it, and took a large interest in animation when he was there.
Ouch, ouch. Did he run the film side? I mean, the live action? I thought he was solely animation.
He was the chairman of Walt Disney Pictures. Or Walt Disney.
I thought animation was his bailiwick. I just watched a film about a documentary about the revival of Disney animation, and I'm pretty sure that was his main area.
Either way, right now he's not there, and the studio is touting a new way to watch DVDs, which is to throw out the DVD entirely. Ethan Smith from the Wall Street Journal had a story a week or so ago talking about a new technology that would enable entertainment companies to adapt their business models to a new reality in which consumers increasingly rely on computers and cell phones in place of DVD players and TVs. And they codenamed this technology KeyChest, and they say it could contribute to a shift in what it means for a consumer to own a movie or a TV show by redefining ownership as access rights, not physical possession. So what they're talking about is once you buy either a DVD or digital download, you will have access to it on your TiVo. You will have access to it on your computer or on your phone. It's kind of an interesting little business model.
Malarkey. It's called subscription services, and it's never worked in the U.S. yet. And after the scare with Amazon's Kindle, where they said, oh, by the way, you don't actually own those books. You just have the right to look at them, and we can take it back whenever we want, which is what they did with a book that they had sold illegally and just reached into people's computers and stole the book back from them, even the personal notes people had written. I think people are very suspicious of it. And this is a technology in search of a solution in search of a problem. People actually don't watch Disney movies on their telephones. And they're not going to. They're not going to sit down and watch an entire film on their iPhone. You know, it doesn't happen except in rare situations. I don't buy it.
Well, that's exactly what it is. A customer or a moviegoer or a media consumer would pay a single price and then get permanent access to a movie or TV show across all of these multiple digital platforms and devices. It's this technology, KeyChest, is going up against another group called the Digital Entertainment Content Ecosystem, DECE, which is being assembled by a consortium headed by Mitch Singer, the chief technology officer of Sony Corp's Sony Pictures Entertainment. Of course, there you have Sony once again going off and forging their own direction. And right now, there are five major Hollywood studios that are backing this DECE initiative, and even Comcast is, and Intel. But Disney and Apple are notable absents.
And it's the same idea, right? You just have access to it. It's they keep the movie, they have it. You never actually own it or download it. You just are able to stream it to whatever product you want. Isn't that what it basically is?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good description. Certainly, it would help with hard drive space.
Well, you know what? I'm right here, and I can't stream a YouTube video that's 3 minutes long without pausing it. I have a weak signal where I happen to be right now, and I have to wait 5 minutes for the thing to upload. You know, it's just. I don't. Practically speaking, most people are not ready for this.
Here's what I think. I think that you're sort of right that it is, it's just searching for a problem to solve or whatever it was that you said. But I think that technology and people are changing so much that first of all, I don't think that you can say that you know just because you don't have, you know, you're not in a place right now where you can you know upload it. That's going to change. And then I also think that the generation below us and the generation below that. It's going to care a little bit less about ownership of a book or ownership of a movie, and it's going to care more about having the ability to stream it on all of their devices. So I don't know if this is the answer, but I find it really interesting that they're actually, you know, looking into it, that they're developing this kind of technology.
Well, Blu-ray and downloads account for 11% of home video sales in North America, and that is a figure which is growing. And so what both Disney and Sony and these groups trying to put these technologies together are really worried about is having a third party, like, say, I don't know, Apple, come up with this particular solution because it didn't really work for them when Apple did it. And they want to be able to...
It did work for them because they had abandoned the single industry and the music industry was dying and Apple offered them a solution that now is the number one grossing music store in the world. So it actually did when every music store is shutting down and Walmart is cutting its space on music, iTunes is their savior. They're just too stupid to know it. But I think Karen is right that young people just want access and that that is a generational shift. But most people don't have a high speed internet access yet. And it's going to be at least a decade before more than 50% of people do.
Wait a second.
Forget 80, 90%.
You really think it'll be 10 years? I bet.
Well, how many people have DVRs? Only 30%. Most people don't even have a DVR. The idea of everybody having a thing that can stream their video and audio from their computer to their TV, that is a long way. That's a decade away before the vast majority of Americans have that.
First of all, I'm trying not to skip ahead to one of our big deals.
No, not yet.
Yeah. I don't want to skip ahead to the U2 story we're going to cover. But since you mentioned DVRs, it's actually 33% of households have
a
DVRs.
A third.
Compared to 28% at this point in 2008. I know this because just this morning there's been a slew of posts and stories about a Nielsen report that shows that DVRs are not killing TV, but actually helping it. And we talked a little bit about this a week or so ago on an episode where some of these shows like House and Heroes, when you combine the live plus 3-day viewing, are actually the ratings are increasing quite substantially, and shows that would be borderline are actually they may not be huge hits, but they're making money.
Well, no. I mean, the biggest show is adding 3 million viewers, which is good, but it's not huge. They're not dropping as much as they thought. Like Gossip Girl, its ratings are down 32%, but with DVR, it brings it back up 20%. So it's really only down 12% from last year, but it's still down. Almost everything except the top five shows, you're talking about like 1 million viewers, 1.5 million viewers in a country with 330 million people. That's not that much.
Well, just 3 years ago, TV executives were trying to sue TiVo, or at least threatened that they would, because they feared that all of these TV watchers would be skipping past their commercials. Now, these same executives, according to Tech Dirt and the New York Times, have fallen in love with their former tormentor, the digital video recorder. According to Nielsen, 46% of viewers 18 to 49 years old, and that's that key demographic that all these advertisers want to push their products to, 46% of them across all four networks taken together are watching the commercials during playback, which is up slightly from last year.
Push. Sorry, I was clearing my throat.
I find that very odd too. Maybe it's just pure laziness. They can't even be bothered to fast forward through the ads. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
No, I would believe it if they said it was the 50 to 80 year olds that weren't fast forwarding through the commercials, but the actual
couldn't find
the
remote.
The ones who actually know how to use a remote, no way. But I think DVR is hurting TV in the sense that they're saying there, even under their estimates, that 55% are not watching commercials. And that's only a couple million people who are DVRing it, according to them. But still, that's a trend that will only grow in the future. So if over half of the people who DVR skip the commercials and they're the key demo, well, that's 1 to 2 million people who just didn't watch your commercials.
Well, I certainly watch more TV because of DVR. I watch programs I never would have watched if I didn't have a DVR. So that's the
and
first
fewer
point.
Commercials.
Well,
but you watch fewer commercials, right?
I do.
But
watch...
you do fast forward through them, and you are watching them. I had a professor at Syracuse who came up with the idea that advertisers should make ads that are only watchable in fast forward, so that when they're going normal, they're like way too slow. But when you're fast forwarding through them, they seem perfectly normal. I think that was a great idea.
There are actually a couple of companies that have done that. Buy.com started it with their ad that was completely silent and just had buy.com in white letters on a black screen for 30 seconds. So that as you were skipping past it, you would see buy.com, and the audio didn't matter. Certainly there are some companies that are trying to figure out a way to make watchers, TV watchers, not skip past the commercials. But before we get to that story, I just wanted to say, Michael, that the way Nielsen gathers this information is from companies like TiVo and their own technology called Stopwatch, I believe, that gets this data anonymously directly from the DVR. So they know down to the exact number of people or number of devices, how many devices have skipped through a commercial. And Brad Adgate, the senior vice president of research at Horizon Media, which is a media buying firm that buys...
By the way, is that guy like the biggest media whore or what? It's all over the place. He's always interviewed for stuff like this.
Well, he's doing his job. He believes
him and Paul Derek Abedian. Oh my God. I feel like I know these people.
Anyway, media whore Brad Adgate. We should get him on the show.
Leave that in.
Michael is now worried that I'm going to edit out media whore Brad Adgate. He believes that...
I love his name is Adgate. It's perfect.
I know. It's perfect, right? I mean, it's like... He's like a character.
I'm going to get both Paul I can't pronounce his last name.
Derek Abadian or something. Yeah.
From Media by Numbers and Brad Adgate from Horizon Media on together. It'll be a battle of the media whores.
And then I'll ask Robert Thompson from Syracuse, the professor of popular culture, and they can all just duke it out.
Well, Brad believes that television watching is a passive activity and that through, you know, normal behavior that people have grown up with, they just kind of forget to press that fast forward button when the commercials come on. And I can say I am definitely guilty of that.
Mm-hmm. What? How could you possibly forget? It's the best part about having a DVR.
Well, because I'm doing other things. And I think that's another issue. I'm, you know, on the internet, I'm typing an email, I'm checking my BlackBerry. And that's when I do all of that, is during that little moment where I have to run to the bathroom or grab a drink. I think people actually need that little moment. In some cases,
you press pause.
Oh, Michael, stop being so technological.
No, but that actually requires you having to do something. I think that what Sperling's saying is making sense. It's like you're multitasking 2 minutes.
Yeah, it makes sense. But again, over half of the people already fast forward through them. And people, as they get the DVR, will learn more and more to not do it. You do forget a little bit early on when you're new to it. You're like, oh, my God, I can get through the commercial. But I think after a year or two, that amount of commercial skipping you do increases exponentially. But you know, the way people watch stuff changes, and like the Disney key chest and the other thing, I was looking up some information that I wanted to get back to, not to confuse everyone. But for example, when Up comes up on a DVD November 10th, for $23, you can buy a combo pack from Disney. And this is a good solution to the problem of flexibility. You get the Blu-ray, which you can use in your home entertainment system if you have it. You get the DVD, which you can put in the kids' room or in the car if you have a road trip and you want to watch a DVD in the van. You get a digital copy, which you can download onto your iPhone or your laptop and take it with you everywhere. And that's available now, and you have control over it, and it's $23. So the idea that I'm going to switch to KeyChest when I could just do that, you know, it doesn't seem to me. They've already got the solution to that flexibility problem, and I think it's a good one, and that's the combo pack. But,
well,
you know,
but that's a solution that has a tangible physical object associated with it, as opposed to this kind of digital, non-tangible product.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Well, just to stay on this whole DVR thing for a second, Business Week had a story that I thought was kind of interesting. we've kind of talked about and touched on in past episodes about how advertisers are working with TV networks, and TV networks are indeed encouraging advertisers to do these custom-made commercials that, like Karen, you pointed out last week, is kind of the way television began, by having Procter & Gamble or a cigarette manufacturer sponsor an entire television show, and there would be no commercials. Instead, the actors or actresses and or the television host would actually pitch the product.
I bet if Lucky Strike were still around, they'd be sponsoring Mad Men.
Totally.
I bet you're right. And the whole point and the whole goal of this is to prevent people from fast-forwarding through these commercials. One executive actually called them fast-forward-proof or DVR-proof. I don't know that they're that, but I will say that the little snippets that Saturday Night Live put in made me stop fast-forwarding through the commercials, and there are these interstitials that are in between the commercials of old Saturday Night Live bits. And so yeah. I would stop fast-forwarding. Microsoft initially was going to sponsor an episode of Family Guy. This was something that everybody was shocked at. Of course, Seth MacFarlane's Family Guy is geared towards a younger audience, many of whom like Apple, and his humor is very... he's got a sharp wit, I'll put it that way. Of course, once they found out who Seth MacFarlane was, they immediately backed out.
How did they not know who he was?
Oh, I don't know. ABC.
How could you have let it get that far and not have researched who you're talking about?
You don't actually have to know what you're doing to earn a huge paycheck from a big technology
There's
company.
My inferiority complex again. I'm like, I just assume you do, and I don't, so I'm not going to go there.
Well, when was the last time Microsoft looked like they knew what they were doing?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, with Bing, they actually do, but that's a whole other story. Desperate Housewives and ABC did these little series of ads for Sprint. I watched some of them, and they are horrible. They're just bad. They're like poorly acted, poorly written. It features a woman who uses her phone to find out whether her husband is cheating, and he's so obviously cheating that you don't need a Sprint phone to figure it out.
Wait, are you serious? That's horrific. Why would you have an ad like that?
Oh, I don't, because it's Desperate Housewives. It features the actors and actresses in the actual television show.
Oh, I hate that show.
Have any of you seen this cotton commercial that Zooey Deschanel is in?
No.
She sings the, you know...
Oh, yes, I have.
The cotton theme song. The look, the feel of cotton. And as I'm watching it, I have to say, every time it comes on, I do stop fast-forwarding, but that has more to do with Zooey Deschanel and her voice than cotton. And I wonder if something like that actually hurts her chances for an Academy Award nomination or any award nomination at the end of this year for 500 Days of Summer.
Well, I doubt she'd get it, but I'd love it if the movie was considered.
Well, so now that we realize we're all fast-forwarding through these commercials, except for the Zooey Deschanel commercial. But when it comes to Hulu, which is one of my favorite topics, I always have to say that, you can't fast-forward through the commercial. And I noticed, Karen, you highlighted this story, Hulu? What happened to Free? You want to fill us in on what this story is about? I did not get a chance to read it. However, I did get a chance to read the story on Jason Kilar, who is the head of Hulu and who helped found Hulu. That story is in Fast Company magazine this month. It is fascinating on how this website, this service, was born.
Yeah, I read that too.
I love it when Jeff Zucker comes in and very wryly says, after looking at everybody, you know, all these young kids at Hulu's headquarters, and they're wearing flip-flops and pizza boxes are strewn everywhere, and he says, "It's not your father's media company."
Oh, I interviewed there about 2.5 years ago. I was so unimpressed by them. My initial reaction was, these are a bunch of douchebags. It was like what MTV wanted to be in the late 80s. It's like you walk in there and they've got like their foosball table and everyone's like wearing their shorts and holding their snacks. And you know, it's just, my immediate reaction was, these people have no idea what they're doing. And this was in the very, very early days of Hulu. So clearly I didn't know anything.
Well, maybe ignorance is bliss, because certainly their website, Hulu.com, and their service is used by 36 million people per month.
Yeah, the Media Freak item we linked to was a very modest little blog post that just talks about how they love free stuff, just like Sperling, And it mentioned this person was shocked when he found that after 40 hours of using Pandora in a month, they charge you $1 to finish the month. Or you can pay $36 to get free play all year long. And he's like, well, the heck with that. I'm going to play iTunes. And he says now the reports that Hulu might charge for some of its content by next year.
And my response to Michael was, call me a Republican, God forbid, because, you know, I'm certainly not. But you've got to make a living. How else are people supposed to make money? I don't understand.
Well, the parts they're trying to charge for so far, from what I've heard, are like the little extras and the little webisodes. So if you wanted to get exclusive content, then you pay. And I think that's actually a decent model. Charge the fanboys.
Yeah.
Why should we not be charged for watching anything on Hulu? I mean, why should we get that content for free?
Because people, you're watching a commercial. You're watching a commercial.
That's how network TV works. You get get TV over the air for free, and they would have ads.
Yeah, I do see your point, but I don't know. There's something about it that the little teeny tiny Republican side to me comes up and say, like, I don't know, people got to make a living.
Yeah, seems reasonable to me. Yeah, they got to make it with people fast-forwarding through ads and skipping everything, that it's harder and harder for them to make a dime, so they got to do it somehow.
Well, I don't know who posted this story, but Karen, your favorite topic, former Letterman writer, sex equals favoritism.
It.
So yeah,
I posted it because I wanted to point out who was right. Huh? Who was right?
So how
did
I
right.
not say
so,
other women were going to come forward?
Yeah.
So why don't you fill us in on this story, because I did not get a chance to read it.
Well, it's just that a woman who was a writer for whatever his show was before he was doing
Late Night with David Letterman.
You know, when he still had brown hair. in the 80s, and she was a writer, and she said that it was a really hostile work environment because she said it was sexually charged, hostile work environment, and that she felt that women who slept with him were getting better opportunities. And because I know you guys are all thinking this, was she an attractive woman? Yeah, she was a reasonably attractive woman. Bad eyebrows, but a reasonably attractive woman, and seemed really smart. And, you know, I don't think she's just coming forward for publicity. I believed her. But the sad thing is that I know most of America, and certainly I would say 60% of men would be like, oh, well, she's just not as cute, man. She was just mad.
Well, no, I certainly believe her. She has nothing to gain by coming forward, you know, two decades after, you know, I mean, you know, I believe her that, you know, the women who were happy and eager to date Letterman found their careers advanced by it. It's depressing.
Well, I think that's true in many scenarios, not just in Letterman's situation. I mean, if you think about it, he actually had a female head writer for quite a number of years.
Who he lived with.
Yeah. Ooh.
Okay, well, there you go. So you see, it did pay off.
and she was a terrific writer, but it's just, yeah, it happens in all over the country, but that doesn't make it good. And it's a bummer when you actually know the person and think you kind of like them.
Well, do you like Paul Haggis? Because he is no longer a member of Scientology. He finds
it
morally reprehensible. And this was actually a big story for last week, that he wrote this letter to the official spokesperson for Scientology, which he had been a member of for 35 years. He does not like the church's stance on Proposition 8, which is the anti-gay marriage bill here in, or proposition since it's not a bill, but it's the anti-gay marriage proposition here in California. And he calls it a hate-filled legislation that succeeded in taking away the civil rights of gay and lesbian citizens of California.
I hope he survives. I hope his career survives. I hope that the Scientology mafia doesn't kill him off.
Well, you know, that's kind of what's interesting, is that this letter was so public. And now, for those who don't know, Paul Haggis is a screenwriter and filmmaker. He won an Oscar for Crash, which he also directed. He wrote Flags of Our Fathers. He had a very good year that year. This letter that he wrote went public. He wrote it to the church's official spokesperson, Tommy Davis, and he wanted Tommy Davis to condemn the Prop 8 sponsorship. The Church of Scientology was one of the sponsors of Proposition 8.
Yeah, well, I think it's a case where, you know, you're part of a group for many years and you don't agree with everything they do, but at some point they cross the line. My understanding of the Church of Scientology has always said, and this was from a spokesperson to me, was that they were not anti-gay, because, but if you went clear, well, you wouldn't be gay anymore. He said it wasn't a cure. No, no, no. But they didn't have people who went clear and were gay, because if you went clear, you wouldn't be gay. But she, you know, adamantly said that this is not to be understood as a cure. It just wasn't something that would happen. The two didn't go together. So they've always had an uncomfortable relationship with gays, as have most organized religion throughout the free world. But I think when they actively supported Prop 8 and said, not only are we not down with gays, but we want to take away their basic civil rights and publicly encourage that, that went across the line for him.
Well, first of all, there's always been some question as to whether Scientology is a religion or a cult, and we should not get into that here. But
well, according to the IRS, it is a religion.
Cult.
And eventually, after a few decades, when people are, their grandparents are Scientologists and their parents are and they're raised as Scientologists, eventually it's like, you know what? Every religion starts as a cult. Catholicism included. So eventually,
I would say all religions are cults, but.
Touche! But what I found interesting, as did the Los Angeles Times' Patrick Goldstein, was that I guess that Proposition 8 stance crossed the line, but this particular point did not. Haggis acknowledges that his wife was ordered to disconnect from her parents because of something they supposedly did 25 years earlier when they resigned from the church. His wife followed the church's orders, refusing to speak to her parents who'd introduced her to Scientology in the first place. As for Haggis, he says that he refused to break off contact, explaining, "I've never been good at following orders, especially when I find them morally reprehensible."
And I'm sure the church would disagree, but I would bet if he was less public and less well-known, that if he did that, that they would have kicked him out of the church. But that's, again, not unusual. There are other Orthodox Jews and other communities and other religions where, you know, if the person breaks with the faith, or the, what about the kids who go wilding? The kids in the, is it Quaker?
Quaker.
When they go Rumspringa?
It's the Amish.
Yeah, if they leave, they're gone. It's the same thing. So, again, this is not unique to Scientology, though certainly not part of my faith.
Well, on that note, I guess we should skip right over to our segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop. Our first story this week is Anthony Hopkins is going to play Thor's dad. I don't even know in what movie, but Anthony Hopkins, the actor.
That would be Thor.
Oh, okay. Well, so is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Ladies first.
Big deal? No, big whoop.
Michael?
I always get mixed up. I get mixed up between which is which. I don't care.
That's a big whoop, I guess. I say it's a big deal because he's now officially Marlon Brando. He's now entered that stage of his career where he just plays walk-on cameo roles like Marlon Brando did in Superman and gets paid a lot of money for it. Congratulations, Anthony Hopkins.
Well, should we also be congratulating January Jones, who is joining the Nicolas Cage thriller, the name of which I do not know. Yeah, it's not here. It's not in the notes. What can I say? Now, I should say, I used to work for Nicolas Cage, and his father, August Coppola, died this past week at the age of 75. August Coppola was Francis Ford Coppola's brother and Nicolas Cage's uncle. Sorry, Nicolas Cage's father. So, my condolences. Okay. Is January Jones joining his next film, a thriller, the name of which we will have to look up?
It's called The Hungry Rabbit Jumps.
Well, is it a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal for her career.
And I think it's a big deal for the show, as these actors are finally starting to have projects come into the pipeline and get ready to be released. Like, I mean, John Hamm and Elizabeth Moss and Christina Hendricks, who is so incredibly sexy and great. I mean, to me, January Jones is the least interesting of those actors. They should all be working in, they should all have movie projects. And you finally start to see them, you know, getting some decent roles. I mean, John Hamm was in that stupid remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still and a couple other things. But he's got some stuff in the works. And hopefully they'll all, you know, spread out to Hollywood because they're talented actors.
Now, the show you're referring to is Mad Men, which appears on AMC television. It's the show that's set in the 60s about advertising executives.
For those who are watching from space.
Well,
wait,
you
just say that you think that January Jones is the least interesting actress?
On that show, I do. Yeah, I do think she'd make a good Hitchcock woman. I think she'd be a great blonde. If Hitchcock were alive, he would use her. She's got that icy reserve. You don't know what to think about her, and yet she's alluring in a way. It may be just be the role that they've written for her. Whereas, you know, Christina Hendricks, who plays the curvy secretary, who's so talented and has such good and has such great a role and has such great stuff to do. Why producers don't snap her up, I don't know.
Because she's heavier than the rest, I would say, and
oh my god, She's so sexy.
I'm just saying this is what I think. And Elizabeth Moss, because she's not as cute. But yeah. January Jones is cute and she's skinny and she's blonde. But, you know, although I've never been a fan of her as an actress, I think she actually makes a really good Betty.
Well, okay. Bottom line, we all think January Jones hooking up with Nicolas Cage, and we mean that in the platonic sense, on a new movie is a big deal. But
good news for Mad Men.
Good news for Mad Men.
Moving on.
Moving on to Jay Leno, who said he would return to the Tonight Show if asked. Is this a big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, because they're not going to ask him anytime soon.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's more like nice try.
So we all agree that's a big whoop. But now here's my big favorite topic for this episode. U2 on YouTube, 10 million streams. U2 performed a concert here in Los Angeles at least in Pasadena, which is close to Los Angeles. They performed it at the Rose Bowl on Sunday, October 25th, and they streamed it live on YouTube. 10 million people around the world watched that. And since then, 2 million people have watched the, I guess, tape delayed. I don't know what you would call it. It was the biggest webcast in YouTube history. It was the biggest live event YouTube ever did. Big deal or big whoop?
Ugh, big whoop. I'm so over YouTube. Does that make me like a Generation Y wannabe? I'm sick of them. Sick. They seem like old people at this point.
I think it's a big deal because it shows how more and more things can be played on websites like this and reach a worldwide audience. 10 million is a huge number for a concert film. If they'd all paid $8 to see it, it would have been three times as big as Michael Jackson's This Is It.
But they wouldn't have paid money to see it.
And actually, I was traveling when that concert was both, you know, played live and streamed. However, when I got home this week from Show East, I turned on my television, and there on TiVo, I could actually stream that whole concert, 2 hours and 21 minutes, right through TiVo, and it looked and sounded fantastic. I watched the whole show. It was unbelievable. I was really impressed, so I do think it's a big deal.
But Karen's right. Things will just be available in the future. You'll just be able to access things in 20, 30, 40 years. Every book, every music, somehow people will get paid for it, but everything will just be accessible to people.
I want it to be in my brain already. I don't even want to have to watch it. And
but
if Google
you're
has...
not alone. A lot of people feel that way.
Well, if Google has their way, maybe it will be. The next story is Google searches for music sales. Google announced an enhanced music search feature late Wednesday that allows those who use the search engine to hear and even buy music via the web giant's dedicated partners. And some of their partners are Lala and MySpace. Big deal or big whoop?
That people can search for music?
Well, it's the way they're searching for music. They can actually listen to that music now right from Google. They can purchase it. Well, not right on Google, but they can be linked off and purchase it. They have deals with Pandora, Rhapsody, and iMeme. So everybody but iTunes.
You know, I don't think it's as big a deal as the news about, you know, Google and Bing adding Facebook and Twitter to their searches. But me personally, I find it quite handy. But ultimately, big whoop.
Michael?
I say it's a medium deal because any competition for iTunes is good, as much as I like it. I like Amazon, and I like the fact that, you know, there are no music stores left. So the more ways people have to buy music and access it easily and buy it cheaply and simply, whether it's those pop-up ads on YouTube when you find a video that you like or this, I think it's good.
Well, certainly that is what everybody is prognosticating, that this will provide some kind of competition to iTunes, because Google, of course, is a force to be reckoned with, and now Google will be sending potential music buyers away from iTunes and to other outlets, Pandora, Rhapsody.
Competing outlets.
Thank you. I was looking for the word. I guess, you know what, that's as good a time as any to segue really poorly to our next segment, Inside Baseball, the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And Karen or Michael, I'm not sure who highlighted it.
I did.
But Miramax president Daniel Batzik is hitting the road.
I really don't have that much to say about it. I just thought it was interesting that that Miramax is like
falling apart at the seams.
Like, it's falling apart. Yeah. I mean, I remember when Miramax was like it, and it was like new, and it was, you know, Bob and Harvey, and it was so cool. And now to just to watch this, just like the death of Miramax.
let's face it, it was a big deal when Bob and Harvey Weinstein ran it, and they were spending $300 million to make Gangs of New York. Now they only have three films on their slate.
I don't understand why Disney couldn't make a deal and keep them in there. I guess it's the story of every studio shutting their indie labels. You know, it was, became vanity projects, you know, Fox Searchlight, Miramax. You know, it was always about the Weinstein brothers. And so once they let them go, it was only a matter of time, I think, before it folded shop.
Well,
but surely they didn't pay $300 million to make Gangs in New York.
Well, I'm sure they spent a lot. Right okay. Now, Miramax only has 20 staffers left. And Variety is saying that, you know, it could possibly be a home for some Screen Gems product or for some of Jerry Bruckheimer's more arty films or Scott Rudin's more high profile dramas. But that.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I guess maybe we should have put that in Big Deal or Big Whoop.
You know what? I was going to put it there, and then I realized we had nothing to talk about from Inside Baseball. I felt it kind of belong there. I mean, honestly, I don't know who this guy is. I don't know who he is. I don't know who any of the players were in Miramax once Bob and Harvey left. I'd have to say, I think that was probably one of the dumber decisions they ever made, was selling their company to Disney
everyone.
And then eventually leaving.
It was dumb of Disney, dumb of them. I think Disney got rid of them. I don't think they wanted to leave so much. If they'd been allowed to keep playing in the way they were, they would have probably stayed happily. But it worked out poorly for everyone, I think.
I would agree.
But and I saw a budget for Gangs of New York of $97 million, according to thenumbers.com.
Okay, well, this podcast is free, and you can subscribe to it on iTunes. In fact,
good segue.
We encourage you to subscribe to it on iTunes and rate it with 5 stars. Although, please feel free to rate it however you'd like with 5 stars. If you want links to any of the stories we talked about or discussed or argued about or glossed over in this episode, feel free to visit our website where you will find them in the show notes for episode 27. You can find our website at showbizsandbox.com. If you would like to email us your thoughts or comments on a story or just give us some feedback, feel free to do so. You can send your comments to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can even leave us a voicemail if you call 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Feel free to talk about any of the stories we've discussed or give us feedback. We will be reading your emails and listening to your voicemails on future episodes of the podcast. Our website is also where you will find links to all of our social networking sites, including Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, the whole usual lot of them. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is from MGMT, the popular indie group. You can visit them on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael, you can be found at michaelgiltz.com and on Twitter. The username to look up is @MichaelGiltz. And Karen, you can be found at Industry Nexus and KarenWoodwardOnline.com.
.com, yep.
And of course, on Twitter, @KWoody3939, I finally memorized it. I can be found.
Thank you.
Yes, I can be found on Twitter as well. My username is @Sperling, and you can read some of my writing on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.